This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, a night at the Overlook Hotel, haunted houses in speculative fiction and their real-life counterparts.
So it's a Halloween special because we've got Samhain coming up. I'm very excited.
Yeah, me too.
This weekend, actually, that this podcast is going out, I'm off to Cornwall. I'm going to go see if I can find any of the ghosts in from I Hold the Tide.
Well, hopefully you won't find the Toll House.
No, indeed. Though, of course, it is worth mentioning that I Hold the Tide has just been released for any of you Unveiled fans out there. If you haven't grabbed your copy yet, make sure you do so soon. It's an excellent one. I've been craving going to... I mean, I've always wanted to go to Cornwall, but since reading it, I've been craving to go, and now it's finally happened. So I'll spend my Halloween weekend in a nice, spooky part of the country.
See, that just sounds awesome. I'm not going anywhere. Except work, maybe.
Well, I'm actually teaching on Halloween itself, but I'm teaching the Gothic, which feels appropriate.
Yeah, definitely.
You planning anything fun for Halloween, Jules?
Nothing specific at the moment. No, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Okay, then. This week we are looking at haunted houses.
Yeah, we've never really talked about haunted houses before. Obviously, we've covered ghosts a bit and Gothic literature a bit, and we've skirted around the side, but haunted houses seem to be in a league of their own.
They do. I mean, everyone loves a good haunted house, don't they?
Yeah.
Or, you know, a haunted building. There's always one in every sort of area, or a haunted part of the building. I mean, ghosts are pretty much ascribed to anywhere which is old or a little bit derelict.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And certainly when you're children, you tend to pass on those sort of stories to each other.
Mm-hmm. You must have had a white lady at your school or something like that.
We had a grey lady.
It's always grey or white.
Yeah, we had a grey lady. And what's funny about it is you expect stories that are just passed down generation to generation to kind of either embellish or gradually to move away from the source material. But anyone who ever said they saw the Grey Lady, who was supposedly... Because the house is a listed building before it became a convent.
Yeah.
And she was supposed to have been a member of the gentry. And something not very nice happened to her. But nobody really knows exactly what it was. It's quite difficult to track down. But the stories of anyone who's supposedly seen her, independently, sort of... They coincide. They do fit together. So that's quite interesting. That suggests that there was at least a basis in the original local legend there that's surviving. It's not just a case of, oh, we made this up because the corridors up by the cloisters are actually pretty creepy, and they were.
Yeah.
But yeah. The school was kind of like Hogwarts without the magic.
Yeah. Well, I was at two boarding schools. And the first one was Port Regis, which is in Dorset. And Dorset is obviously very nicely haunted.
Ghost Central.
Ghost Central, yeah.
I grew up in Dorset as well, obviously.
So the school was close to Shaftesbury, and it was called, the house itself that was converted into the school was Mockham House. And it was humongous. It was this very, very old building, and it was actually quite spectacular. And there was, they had this amazing, like, old, it was called the Old Assembly Hall. And it had this humongous fireplace, and above it was the boys' boarding house and stuff like that. And it was a pretty substantial building. And of course, we had so many ghost stories. And the problem was that it had super creaky floorboards that once you'd stood on them, like, it would take them a while to spring back up again.
Yeah.
So I just remember being the only one awake at night and listening to the floorboards creak, and it sounded like someone was walking towards you down the corridor, but there was never anyone there. So it was the most terrifying thing. And so far as my investigations have shown, there aren't actually any particular ghost stories which are attached to that building, but as in none that have been recorded, though I'm sure if I look a little bit deeper, I will probably find something, because a building of that age, it's got to have at least one gruesome story. And there were definitely stories which were passed around by the pupils about the butcher who chased one of the maids around, and as she tried to escape through one of the windows, she got stuck between the bars and he just cut her into little pieces from the feet up to the waist. Yeah. You know, the typical kind of gruesome stuff that you get from young children.
Yes.
So yeah, so that was Port Regis. And yeah, you've got to love a good ghost story. And any old building, there's going to be one. But there are a few which have been so famous that they've actually inspired stories or even been made into films.
Yeah, a good one perhaps to start with for me is, obviously it's going to be Stephen King, but it's Rose Red. And he more or less wrote it as a, well, as sort of a screenplay. But the actual mansion of Rose Red, he based on a true story, the story of the Winchester Mansion.
Ooh.
And I'm paraphrasing a little bit here because there's a bit of debate on the timeline and things like that. But allegedly, Sarah Winchester, the wife of the gun magnate who built the Winchester Mansion in the first place, and, you know, it's a stunning Queen Anne type building, you know, really, really amazing. But she was told by a clairvoyant that she would not die if she kept building. And it's called the Winchester Novelty Mansion now, because there's all these rooms where you walk into a room and it's actually upside down. So it looks like you're walking on the ceiling with the lights hanging down towards the centre of the room and the chairs on the ceiling and things like that. And there's trick doors and trick rooms. And it just became new things to build to keep going. Obviously, Stephen King in Rose Red takes this to the nth degree. And Rose Red is most definitely haunted. It was a bad house from the moment its first foundations were laid, and the number of people who died in the construction. It's this huge vampiric entity that particularly likes psychics, but, you know, anyone will do. It especially likes ladies.
Yep.
The things that happen to the men there are not very nice at all. It's a really good mini-series. It's probably a little bit dated in terms of effects now, but as usual with Stephen King, the aftertaste, the idea that there's this thing, this sort of vampiric entity where the house was built, the house just became a focal point for it, is really genuinely quite creepy.
And he was actually quite good at doing that. I mean, some of the scary things about King's writing is he does actually centre around he tends to have these things which sort of go a little bit deeper, if that makes sense. For instance, in Salem's Lot, you've got, and I've just forgotten the name, but you've got the house where the Mr. Barlow goes to live. But previous to that, it was kind of already haunted. It was a centre point for evil. And some other evil kind of had happened there. And that's never really explained. It just is the idea that a house can remember the evil things that have happened in it.
Yeah, definitely. His other great haunted house, which is actually a hotel, is the Overlook Hotel, which turns up in two books. Obviously, The Shining.
Yep.
And then the book that's sort of a sequel set a good 20 years later, or 20 or 30 years later, in fact, called Doctor Sleep, which sees the young Daniel Torrance as a grown man going back and facing his fears at the Overlook. And personally, I think Doctor Sleep is a better book than The Shining. The Shining has dated quite a lot for me.
Yeah.
But the Overlook Hotel itself, I mean, even if you haven't read the book, you've probably either seen the film with Jack Nicholson in, or you've seen the newer film, or perhaps you've just seen memes, which give you an idea. And it's absolutely terrifying. The house and Jack Torrance, who is, you know, a struggling alcoholic. He's a struggling writer as well, but he's struggling with his alcoholism, and they're locked away in this house over the winter. and it's right up in the mountains, so when the snow comes, you can't get out for months at a time. So there's everything there that they need, including, like, an entire legion of ghosts. And it starts to play on his mind, and he starts to unravel to the point where, you know, spoilers, guys, but he then attempts to murder his family, which is what's happened to people there in the past. You know, he goes insane with it.
Yeah.
And his son, Daniel, who is about 4 or 5 in the book, is what, can't remember what the guy's name was, his friend, the chef who leaves, mm-hmm. calls a shiner, somebody who shines, a psychic. And he's trying to warn his father, but, you know, he's restricted by the fact that he's, you know, about 5 years old.
Yeah.
So being able to read people's minds, being able to see ghosts, and the ghosts really target him because, you know, he can see them without much effort on their part. So they're sort of feeding off this whole thing. And then later in Doctor Sleep, because he's never, unfortunately, Danny goes down the same path as his father. He goes through a stage of being an alcoholic because he cannot cope with what he can see.
Yeah.
And he comes out the other side of it, but there's always something there. He's weakened himself. He's weakened his psychic ability by becoming an alcoholic, by doing some dreadful things while he was drunk.
Mm.
And he goes back to face his demons to go in aid of another psychic who's an even more powerful shiner than he was. It's really, really interesting. And I do think, it, you know, Stephen King doesn't usually write sequels, but that was one that definitely needed to be written.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea that there was any sequel at all.
But yeah, the Overlook Hotel itself is terrifying. Even I find it terrifying.
You find it terrifying.
Yeah, I have very low tolerance for finding ghost stories scary. As in, I'll enjoy them quite often, but I don't usually find them scary.
It's just, this takes me back to something you were writing for me. You sent me that chapter and I said, Christ, Jules, that last chapter was really scary. And you were like, was it? I didn't include anything scary in it. And I was like, there was something crawling out of the well, Jules. There was a creature crawling out of the well. That's scary. And you were like, meh. It's like you weren't even trying. And the best bit was that it was the implication that you're like, oh no, I haven't even written the scary bit yet. I am not prepared for when you write the scary bit.
I must finish that. yeah.
Yeah, haunted hotels. That's another thing. It's haunted schools, churches, old buildings and hotels.
Anywhere that's seen the passage of a lot of feet over time, I think, to castles and things as well.
God, when you say it like that, it sounds really weird. Like ghosts have a foot fetish.
You took that to a very strange place.
I'm sorry, that was what it sounded like. But yeah, it's definitely, yeah, seen a lot of people come through. It's no wonder that they've got stories attached to it.
It's like there's a lot of ghost stories that report sightings on stairs or, you know, corridors and things in castles, which would make sense if you like, because if anything is going to sort of record a memory, if you like, then it would be somewhere where something happens a lot. So people go past each other in corridors or they walk up and down stairs a lot. So crossing places.
Yeah, crossroads of some description.
Yeah, definitely.
Entrances. Yeah. I do remember hearing a ghost story of just... again, it was an old castle. It might have even been Hampton Court, of a guy who was working there, and a woman in full dress and everything walked toward him, and he stepped out of the way to let her pass, and then he took about 3 steps and stopped and went, wait, what the hell? Looked across and she was gone. He just stopped and went, wait a second, that's not modern clothing.
It was probably a good idea to step out the way, though, because, as I understand it, it's extremely unpleasant to have one walk through you. So,
yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is that, yeah, it's not a surprise that you get so many ghost stories attached to places which are also open to the public.
No.
Because on the supernatural side, you say, you know, some people have got the ability to see those kinds of things. On the other side of it is that with that many people, you're going to have a certain amount who are going to start saying the same thing, especially if they already know the story. I mean, suggestibility is also, you know, hysteria, you know, implanting ideas. whether you believe in the supernatural or not, it wouldn't be a surprise that people would see things.
No, definitely. Obviously, you've got things like the Tower of London, supposedly haunted by Anne Boleyn, carrying her head, which to me has always struck me as a little fanciful.
Yeah, I've been to the Tower of London, and I mean, there were a couple of places where I definitely felt really sort of gross.
Yeah.
But the torture influence probably didn't help in that. Yeah, so there are definitely a couple of places I felt really gross, but I certainly didn't see anyone carrying their head around. I mean, I don't know why she would be carrying her head around, to be honest.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? But even if that's recorded as a memory, then picking up your... I mean, it's not like Saint Denis, is it, who allegedly picked up his head and walked all the way to the river?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a Saxon saint who did something like that as well, I think.
Yeah.
But that again, that's sort of... I guess... Obviously, ghosts get used as a tourist attraction.
Yes.
As so, well.
Come to the Tower of London and find a... meet our headless ghost.
Meet our headless ghost.
She's a bit prickly.
Well, you would be if you'd lost your head.
Yeah, or nearly headless Nick, who didn't quite lose it. So yeah, bloody, I mean, that they're the famous ones in the UK. So the Bloody Tower is obviously one of them. Hampton Court is another very, very famous one. It's all these Tudors, right?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of Tudor-type ones down, I'm thinking in Dorset as well, and...
What's in Dorset?
Well, I mean, you can't walk 5 yards in Dorset without finding something haunted, apparently. we found growing up. We particularly had this house called Lime Lodge that was long abandoned. I don't think anyone ever actually saw anything there, that's the thing. But it was, I will say that that house gave you a really uncomfortable feeling for no particular reason. It was, I don't think there was any one of us as younger teenagers who didn't like put on an extra burst of speed to get past that quickly at night. There was definitely something a bit creepy about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been around that bit of Dorset because we had a little visit.
We did. I want to go on another ghost tour.
It wasn't actually supposed to be a ghost tour. It was just incidental that a lot of the things I showed you
had ghost stories attached to it.
Yes.
We did find some interesting stuff, it must be said. I always end up finding interesting stuff whenever I go anywhere with you. It's like you're a magnet for it.
Yes. The weird, the strange.
The unexplained.
The unexplained. So yeah. I used a lot of those things for my books, so...
Yes, I hadn't noticed. So yeah, but I mean, the thing with Hampton Court is that castles like that and the stories attached to it have obviously featured in films and stuff like that. But I'm trying to think of exact... films which have been inspired by allegedly haunted locations, as in based on a true story. And there was one which is, what is it, the most haunted place in Britain. And I cannot for the life of me remember what it was called.
Well, I can tell you what the current supposedly most haunted place in Britain is supposed to be, and that's the Ram Inn in Wootton-under-Edge, which is just down the road from where I work.
Of course it is. So tell me about that, then.
The guy who owned that used to come into the library on a regular basis, so I got to know him quite well, and he's all by himself. He's in his 80s now. But the Ram Inn was built in 1127, and it was used as a lodging house for the people who were building the nearby St. Mary's Church, which dated back to, you know, just after the Norman Conquest, to house their slaves and servants who were building the church for them.
Right.
So it's a really old place, and they worked out that there had been a house there before this one was built. So it actually dates back to the Domesday Book. So that's a good 1,000 years at least. There was likely a pagan burial site on the area because obviously they came along and built their church and built their house and everything. And it's supposedly at the juncture of two ley lines, one of which runs all the way to Stonehenge.
Lord in heaven, it's just getting worse and worse, isn't it?
Oh, I haven't even got in the house yet. There was also a witch burning on the site.
Oh, and come on.
Apparently the spirit of the witch attached itself to one of the rooms in the house, which is now called the witch's room, and has been called the witch's room for anyone who wanted to stay there, because it was a bed and breakfast for a while. It didn't do very well as a bed and breakfast. People used to leave in the middle of the night. There's a monk, allegedly, as well. And, you know, the owner who used to come into the library and talk quite frankly about it, perfectly level, said he'd had all sorts of experiences there, like being dragged out of bed in the middle of the night by something that just wasn't there, and shoved down the stairs, various other things. And I was sort of like, why are you still living there? He's like, oh, it's been in my family for generations. I'm not moving out because of a few ghosts.
Maybe he'll join them when he's done.
Yeah, possibly.
Listen here, you bastards.
But, you know, the building, which is, you know, it dates back, obviously, nearly 1,000 years, and it is mostly on the outside, one of the old 1600s black and white type houses, you know, with the black beams and white plaster, has been on all sorts of, like, shows for ghost hunters, things like that. They used to do ghost tours there, but I don't think they do anymore.
That's a shame. That's amazing.
So, yeah, it's just down the road at Potter's Pond.
Absolutely. Why do you live in the most haunted place ever? Seriously.
Well, I didn't do it on purpose. I found this out after I started working there.
Well, it's also like, you used to live close to that building where someone was a murderer, isn't that right? The slaughterhouse?
Oh, that was when I was a child. Yeah, that was really weird. Literally, sort of, just down the road from where I used to live when I was sort of 2-3 years old, there was the old slaughterhouse, and it had been like barred up for ages. I don't think it hadn't been used in decades, but there was some really weird stuff going on there as well, and it was always made me uncomfortable even as a very small child. I can remember sitting in my pushchair, my dad pushing me up the road past it, and I was an extremely chatty little child. I thought I was making sense, but I probably wasn't. But you used to go dead quiet when I went past that.
Yeesh.
Some sort of deal that went wrong there. And a man murdered his friend and his wife. Ended up dying himself. He got hanged, I think. But I didn't know any of that at the time. This is only stuff I found out years and years later. They turned it into a block of flats, which is what it is now.
Have I had any problems with that?
Not that I've heard of. But, I mean, I'm not in Dorchester very much. So...
found some other haunted place to go to.
As I said, not deliberately.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think that's the thing, though, because buildings can, not consciously remember, but they can sort of absorb, everyone's felt bad vibes, if you like. Everyone's had a bad atmosphere. And I think sometimes buildings can stand there, and if things continually happen there, or perhaps if something particularly bad happens there, maybe some people pick up on it.
Mm. Yeah.
It's my not very scientific explanation.
No, I don't think that's necessarily wrong. I actually used to live in a haunted house. I used to live in... This is in West Sussex. I live in a haunted forest, which is the St. Leonard's Forest. And that is in West Sussex. It is actually attached to the old building that I used to live in. Both times my family have moved into old houses which have been converted into smaller apartments.
Yeah.
And the first one I used to live in was Roppy Park. Now, Roppy Park was originally a big house, and it was converted into... apparently an asylum, an actual genuine asylum. And then during the wartime, it was again changed, and it would welcome soldiers from the war as a sort of a hospital and a rehabilitation centre. So that actually the part that we lived in was the nurses' home. So we never actually had really any problems where we were, but there was an apartment at the back in the top building of the old house which no one could stay in for more than a year. People would move in and then they'd move out again, and it was constantly on sale, and apparently it was haunted, and not there was never any sort of tales of any kind of spectre of any specific kind. But it was this suppressive emotion. People would feel absolutely miserable in this house. They'd feel scared. They'd feel watched, things like that.
Yeah.
And of course, it's interesting that this happened over and over again. There was something about the atmosphere of this house which meant that people just couldn't abide it. So rather than remembering necessarily things that happened or people that went past, it seems like the house almost absorbed the general atmosphere that was present in its history.
Yeah, that would make sense. I've been to old hospitals that are a bit like that.
Yeah.
And there are certain parts of it where you just get that very strange sort of oppressed feeling, like everything's pushing down on you. And perhaps anything that you've been okay with, but things in your life that might make you a bit sad, suddenly really hit you out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then you find out later that, oh yeah, that's where all the so-and-so patients who died of such-and-such were, you know, for the short period of time they had left, living in pain and despair before they shuffled off the mortal coil kind of thing.
Hooray!
But yeah, and it is part of this whole, I don't know, like the stones remember type thing.
Yeah.
I never took you to St. Catherine's Chapel in the end, did I? Because we didn't get round to it.
No, you didn't. Well, as I said, ghost tour. Ghost tour!
Ghost tour.
But no, that wasn't actually the building that I was originally talking about. A building which, again, I'm almost certain was turned into a film, was one where there had been a fire of some description, and there's the very famous images of someone, of something being scrawled on the wall, and the tenants in the house would reply saying, "I don't understand, please explain," and then there'd be more graffiti on the wall. Do you remember that?
No, but I mean, I have to say I'm a bit hit and miss with watching those sort of films because I quite often find the plot a bit lacking and it's not scary enough to interest me. So...
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, I remember seeing things like the Amityville Horror, which doesn't strike me as a haunted house, that strikes me as a haunted family, and I know that seems like it's splitting hairs, but I really don't think it is. It's what's very noticeable, and this is not me casting aspersions, it's just noticeable from reading a few of these sort of cases. When you get reality television doing something like talking about a possession or something in a family mm-hmm. by a spirit or, you know, a demon, allegedly, what's very noticeable is there are nearly always teenage girls involved.
Yeah.
And there's nearly always at least one, if not both, quite suppressive parent figures who are usually very strongly into some organised religion. Generally, it's Christianity of some stripe or another.
Yeah.
So you have this claustrophobic atmosphere of superstition and guilt to start with, which doesn't help. And then you add teenage girls who are already somewhat suppressed and have been ever since they were toddlers, because that's what they've been taught. And even though, you know, it's pseudoscience to say this, so, you know, don't take me literally. Nobody's really proved anything yet.
Yeah.
But people having inexplicable psychic bursts of psychic activity, like poltergeist phenomenon, because poltergeist phenomenon is usually to do with things like teenage girls going through a brief phase of, you know, they can't act out themselves, so mm-hmm. it's sort of bursting out of them in other ways.
Yeah.
So it's things like brief bursts of telekinesis and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, you put something like that in an atmosphere that's already really claustrophobic and suppressive, and then you add guilt to the equation. Guilt's, you know, a bad emotion. It's really quite controlling.
Mm.
And I think what you get then is like this, so it's a positive feedback thing. So you've got the parent figures looking for evidence of evil, because if there's evidence of evil, then there will be evidence of good.
Yeah.
And the child, who's suddenly getting more attention, is unwittingly producing these things, whether they're genuine, whether they're doing them in some sort of almost fugue state and they don't realise they're doing it, whether they're doing it deliberately because they haven't really had this attention before,
mm-hmm.
to keep the fever going. It's almost like a mini Salem witch trials.
Yeah.
So it's very noticeable in a lot of these stories of, you know, families experiencing a possession or whatever, that you get those things happening. Mm-hmm. The exception was something like, you know, the film The Exorcist.
Yeah.
Which did actually genuinely make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when I watched it the first time. They'd cut half an hour out of it, so it made no sense whatsoever, but there were bits of it that genuinely got, oh god. That must have been the last bit of Catholicism leaving me. But the original story that was based on was a teenage boy. They changed it to a girl in the film because they thought, and quite rightly, that a girl would be a more sympathetic character for being possessed.
Yeah, it was the German boy, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. So, as I said, the whole haunted family thing, if you create this thing in your family yourself, even if it's just a mindset shared between four people who live in very close proximity, that's a haunted family. You can move them wherever you like, the thing will still go with them because they created it. And it's not a conscious entity, it's just this parental child expectation and in quite an unhealthy relationship. And then, you know, throw God into the equation as well, because why not? And you're going to get quite a nasty dynamic until something gives, which I think is what happened with the Amityville Horror. That's just my theory. I'm not a psychologist or anything, but it's just my personal opinion.
No, I was just going to say, the building I was thinking of was the Borley Rectory, which is in Essex, I believe.
I don't think I've heard that one.
Okay, it was a parish, so we do have... Again, we have that religious that religious element to it. And it was set on fire. I say set on fire. It was pretty badly damaged by a fire in sort of 1939. And it's now been demolished since. It was demolished about 5 years later. But... yeah, it was named the most haunted house in England by Harry Price. Do you recognise that name?
Yes, he was a ghost hunter, wasn't he?
He was, yes. And all sorts of strange things occurred in it. And again, one of the famous things was writing appearing on the walls. And the members of the house actually tried to... speak to the ghosts, and the ghosts eventually became quite violent. And I think in particular one of the people who was assaulted was the mother, and I think the wife of the, I can't remember whether he wasn't a priest, he might have been a, oh gosh, I can't remember what's the title called. I mean, her name was Marianne, I believe, Marianne Foister. And so she sort of began to be targeted by the ghosts. And it's since been made into a film.
No, I didn't realise that. I knew they'd done a TV series because someone wrote two books about Harry Price, didn't they? Fiction books. One of them got adapted for TV.
It might have been TV or it might have been... a film. All I know is that it did inspire a story, and I think the Borley Rectory was one of the first, maybe to. It was quite famously sort of investigated, and probably set the bar for a lot of haunted house stories that followed on from it.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's definitely a big difference if you look at, say, ghost and haunted house stories of the Victorian era or just after, and the ones that came sort of after the Second World War. And what's really noticeable is that after the Second World War, the ghosts are much more active, as in physically, them being there is not enough to be frightening anymore. The fact that they're interfering with life.
Yeah.
And sometimes quite violently, as you say.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Now, we mentioned the exorcism of... The Exorcist. And I feel like we should probably mention the exorcism of Emily Rose. However briefly, because obviously I know that it's not a haunted house, but it is an interesting sort of phenomenon, because that was another one which was based on a true... story. I also believe that the exorcist, was his name Roland Doe?
The boy?
Yeah, the boy. Is that Roland Doe?
Honestly, I can't remember. It was more something that I picked up in passing. I found the whole thing quite horrific. at the time. Although I expect if I watched it now, I'd find it very dated and a little bit dull. But
probably. But no, so the real Emily Rose was Annalise Michelle, or Michael, who was initially diagnosed with grand mal seizures because she'd lose control of her body and she'd start shaking intensely.
Yeah.
But she then started to act very strangely. She would attack people. She apparently would drink her own urine, which was fun. And she would shy away from sort of religious objects and sort of react violently around them. So they performed multiple exorcisms on her. And I think there was, as within the film, there was an investigation into this treatment of her. Because, yeah, she had about 40 exorcisms. And she died of pneumonia in the sort of the mid-1970s, 1976. And there was an investigation as to this negligence, basically, of someone who was deemed to be mentally unwell, but whom the family was sure was actually possessed.
Yeah, it's really quite heartbreaking, really, isn't it? It's very much like it's like when I was talking about The Good People by Hannah Kent and how they drowned the child who quite probably had cerebral palsy because they assumed he was a changeling. It's that sort of level of ignorance.
Yeah, it is.
And yeah, there, that is the problem with a lot of exorcisms and things like that, is the fact that most of the time it might well be something like mental illness.
Yeah.
And obviously, from a personal level, the misinterpretation and the misdiagnosis of epilepsy hits home.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to lock women up for that because they were considered to be sexually deviant if they had seizures. So obviously that doesn't sit well with me.
But... No. No, and I completely understand. Yeah, understandably it doesn't sit well with you. It doesn't sit well with me either. And you know, but it's true and it's terrifying. And... the film is almost gross in some ways, because what it does is that it basically says, but what if it was true? What if this wasn't just medical negligence?
What if
she had actually been possessed?
I think, not actually seeing that film, so I don't know if it does this, but I do find in those sort of films, and there are several of them, you do find the girl, and it nearly always is a girl. It's sort of sexualized by the way she's filmed as well.
Yeah,
because she's normally on the cusp between adolescence and adulthood, and then how it's filmed is also quite disturbing.
Yeah, and she's always pretty, even if she, you know, even when she's, there are pictures of Annalise, Michael, toward the end, and they're quite horrific pictures. There's even recordings and videos of her. And this is not someone who's sexualized. This is someone who's in desperate need of help, and they're very alarming, actually. There's this weird sort of sexualization of young women in movies who are being possessed. Well, I was going to say another example of that, but sort of on the flip side of it, was another film called The Entity. Which was a 1982, it was released in 1982, and the story is of sort of a woman who is being basically assaulted sexually and tortured by ghosts in her home. And apparently it is based on a true story, which is that in 1974, the woman, whose name was Doris Byther, basically came out and said that she was being assaulted by ghosts. And obviously most people didn't believe her, but there were a few who did, including some ghost investigators who sort of went in and had a look around. And I believe her son came forward in 2010 or 2009 and basically said, no, it was true, living in the house. His quote is, living in that home was hell. We all experienced some form of attack. There was pushing, biting, scratching being done to us. There was about four entities in the home, and they made themselves known by appearing it all the time. I think it took a lot of energy for them to do that. And that he could hear, he said, my room was right next door to my mother's. I would hear the attacks happening, things being thrown, her screaming. Then she would come out of the bedroom and have all these bruises on her legs, her inner thighs, just like in the movie. Now that's terrifying.
Yes.
That's really scary. There isn't actually that much more detail about it that I've been able to find, though. I'm sure that if I dig a little bit deeper, there will be sort of further explanation of the story behind the entities and what was apparently haunting the building. But, you know, trust Hollywood to be able to take some of the most awful experiences that people have and turn them into
entertainment.
Though, you know, yeah. Clearly the story was sold. So,
See, I find myself in a bit of a difficult position there because I am open-minded about the supernatural.
Yes.
But there is still a small, hard, cynical core of me that goes, okay, but how could it possibly be conceived without the intervention of the supernatural?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is obviously that the person has done it to themselves.
Yes.
Which is awful, but is a possibility. I'm not saying that's what's happened, but I'm just saying this is where my thought process goes with this. And with the whole exorcism thing, which I won't go into too much, but you get somebody from the outside who starts suggesting that your child is possessed by a demon or whatever, if you like. And I've actually read cases where there's a strong possibility that something like that may well have been going on, or at least, you know, it doesn't follow the pattern that you see when there's a con artist involved.
Mm-hmm.
So at least it's different enough to make you stop and think, maybe. Certainly the ones where he gets to that horrible stage where you're having multiple exorcisms and nothing's working, that's probably because somebody on the inside of that particular circle is really invested in it continuing.
Yes.
Until something breaks.
Yeah.
And I suppose you get something a bit like the sunk cost fallacy, whereby the other people involved have to believe it because they've done all these terrible things. And if they then turn around and admit they were wrong, then they have to admit that they've basically abused this child. And perhaps that's not what they set out to do. Perhaps they genuinely believed from the start and now they're having to reassess. And most people will not reassess a situation like that because it's too painful mentally to do it, which is why people then die.
That's the only reason people die.
Well, they'll keep going. I mean, you said she died of pneumonia. One of the big things that's very noticeable in exorcisms is that they will put the child in soaking wet cloth in winter, tied to a bed next to a window with the windows open, no heating or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's not surprising they get things like pneumonia or they die of exposure in their own bedrooms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite disturbing. It's something that was mentioned in a book called A Head Full of Ghosts by Peter Tremblay, and at the end of the book you're still left not quite knowing, but that it's a really good book, but it have all the marks of a, you know, a botched exorcism, a teenage girl who might be acting out, or she might not be, there might be something else going on, two parents who are quite probably mentally ill in their own ways, who are very invested in this particular lie, and a charismatic priest from the outside who seems very invested in doing something great with the Lord's name, and then a TV crew who are coming in to profit on it like a load of vultures with cameras kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and it does follow that same pattern.
And the thing is that, you know, I have actually heard the argument that, you know, if this person wasn't possessed, you know, why are they thrashing around and stuff like that? I'm like, I don't know, if I was tied to a bed and kept constantly awake, you know, for hours, that they're kept awake, it's a form of torture. You're kept awake, you're convinced, everything is raised, you are being tortured.
You might start believing that you're possessed.
Exactly, yeah, you might start believing you're possessed. At this point, they're probably feverish. Okay, they've been starved. They probably don't want to, you know, listen to what their parents are saying. It's terrifying. You know, exorcisms are terrifying, and there was a there was a moment in sort of Da Vinci's Demons in season one which summed it up quite well, which is that this illness was spreading around the nuns, and it was in a convent, and a sort of a poison had been released, and it was affecting all of the nuns, and they were sort of going crazy. They would have visions and stuff like that, and they'd just go a bit bonkers. They'd sort of have to be tied down, and this priest came to sort of cleanse them because he said they were possessed. And what would do is that he would cleanse them, and they'd die, and just as they died, he said, "Ah, I saw the clarity. They have returned to the Lord." and of course they have. Like, because what are they supposed to do? They're dead.
But the community, like, you're not going to say you got it wrong, are you?
Yeah, and Leonardo da Vinci was there, and he's there like, "So how many people, how many exorcisms have you failed?" He said, "I've never failed a single exorcism." He's like, "And how many people have survived?" And he's there like, and he just walks on, and she's like, right. Because, yeah, you can't fail if they're dead.
I mean, it's worth mentioning at this point that you cannot perform an exorcism in, say, Church of England or Protestant Church or Catholic Church without either a special dispensation from the Catholics' point of view from Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You actually need a written dispensation. Or you need it from the head of church in C of E and Protestant as well. So you can't do it. What bothers me is that you have some of these little evangelical side churches that just sort of go rogue and seem to do it anyway, without any higher authority to answer to. Most of the older, more traditional churches have actually dropped the term exorcist because of the connotations, and it's now called deliverance ministry. But there is still a chapter that is open that does things like this, and most of it is to do with helping people adjust when they're grieving, for example.
Yeah.
A lot of it isn't actually, you know, wrestling with demons, as it were, although that is something that is still taught. It's very interesting to read about.
That sort of mildly terrifies me.
I just find it fascinating. I'm obviously really morbid.
I mean, I'm also fascinated by it, but I am also terrified.
A book that I found genuinely frightening that genuinely really freaked me out is The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a haunted house type story, and you're left at the end, spoilers, not really knowing if the house was ever haunted or whether it wasn't the main character making it happen all along, because the main character's an outsider. This is post Second World War, when the old gentry classes are fading and falling into poverty. This guy was brought up in a working class family, but he's done quite well. He's become a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But at that particular time, you would have still used the tradesman's entrance. You wouldn't have been considered quite good enough. He's always felt like he was cut off from the society he thought he should inhabit.
Yeah.
And it's very noticeable when you think back once you get to the end of the book that the bad things that happen, you know, the mother being attacked, the dog going for somebody, all those things start happening once he's been slighted in some way by the upper crust.
Yeah.
It's there's this just very memorable scene at the end because everybody has died. The last members of that family have died in that house through one thing or another. All quite mysterious circumstances. No obvious murder, as it were.
Mm.
But you do find yourself thinking, who was it? And he comes very close to admitting the truth. He's the only person who's still got a key to this old house that he's wanted so badly for so long.
Yeah.
And he happens to look up just as it's getting dark and he sees himself in the mirror, and for a moment he thinks he's genuinely seen the little stranger that haunted the house, and then realises it's just his reflection and turns away. And you wonder if perhaps it's not been his id the whole time.
Yeah.
Or if he hasn't been doing it physically the whole time. That particular idea that there might be some dark acquisitive part of you that issued out without your knowledge and does these terrible things because you want something so badly, you're greedy for it, is really frightening.
But I do like it.
It's a really, really good book.
Oh, I will definitely have to read that. That might not want to be one of my Halloween reads if I really want to freak myself out.
Freaked me out.
If it freaked you out, I have no chance. I think we're coming to the end there now.
We are. Let's finish off with a personal one, because you've already talked about a haunted house. Why don't you tell us a little ghost story, and I'll tell you a little ghost story, and we'll end it there.
A little ghost story. Well, I'll tell you about... There's lots of little haunted places in Winchester, which are great, actually. Lots of little sort of spots. Not quite, I think, as good as Dorset, but I'm happy with the few that I have. And there's one called the Eclipse Inn. I believe last year I spoke a little bit about the Hyde Tavern, so I'll mention the Eclipse Inn this time instead. And the Eclipse Inn is, as imagined, it was an old inn, and I'm not sure whether they still welcome people overnight, but it's a tavern of kinds, and it's very, very old. And during the Monmouth Rebellion, a woman there basically... helped some of the rebels and was tried and arrested, and she was executed publicly in the square on the high street, but she spent her last night in the Eclipse Inn, and apparently one can still see her looking down from the window to this day. And I quite like it. And I do always get a little bit of a spooky feel every time I go to the Eclipse Inn. I tell you what, I had to go upstairs at one point. And sort of the downstairs okay, though it feels a bit suppressive at points. It's definitely a nice little place to visit. I do recommend it. You get a little funny feeling. And as I was going up the stairs, I kind of felt like everything was swaying from side to side.
Yeah.
And the same when I was going down the stairs, and I thought I felt so woozy and so lightheaded, and I thought, oh god, I must be coming down with something. And then the moment I stepped outside, absolutely fine.
Huh.
Not a problem. So that's the Eclipse Inn. I think that's, well, it's not really scary, but that's my experience. Go on, you tell us a story, Jules.
Do you want to hear one my gran told me?
Oh, yes!
This is, according to my grandmother, a true story. It's about the Bay and Shay.
Oh, God, yes, I love the story.
Obviously, Bay and Shay translates to fairy woman, but they're also considered to be sort of ghosts. You might say banshee. I think it's slurred to banshee over here. But they're supposed to follow particular families. I think there are the five great Irish families. They're supposed to follow them and wail when somebody in the family is about to die. Now, when my gran was a little girl, my grandmother was one of 14 children. They all lived in a very small house together. They weren't a rich family at all. And it was the house sort of shit. I mean, they didn't have indoor plumbing in the same way either. This is in Templemore, in Tipperary in Ireland. Anyway, the streets used to share a single toilet. And they were pretty rural as well, so... You know, it wasn't quite at the time when everybody used to go barefoot, but and they did attend school and things like that. So things had moved on a little bit, but this would have been in the 1920s? Yeah, 1920s. There was another woman who had, I think, 8 children. They were the two big families with lots of young children in on that particular street. One night my gran, who was one of the elder children, remembers someone knocking on the door, and her mother answered the door, and there was the woman from across the road saying, you know, are all your kids inside? And my great-grandmother would have said, well, yes, of course they're all in. You know, what would they be out at this time for? And she said, someone's been knocking on my door. Someone's been knocking on my door. My great-grandmother said, well, you know, it's none of my children. Everybody's here. Everybody's gone to bed, kind of thing. This woman went on home, and presumably she tried a few of the neighbours as well and said, is it any of your children knocking my door? I'm going frantic every time I answer the door. There's no one there, which sounds like an epic game of knock and run, but really did not turn out to be one.
No.
My gran says she remembers that night hearing this awful wailing sound coming from the peat bogs. She said you couldn't mistake it for anything else. It wasn't like a fox screaming or anything like that. You couldn't quite put it into words. And then the following morning, it turned out one of the woman's children had died in the night. Anyway, a couple of days later, the same thing. She frantically bangs on the door. My great-grandmother answers the door, and she said, "Someone's knocking on my door again. Are you sure it's none of your children?" It's like, no, they're all in. Same thing happens again in the morning. One of the women's children is dead.
Crazy.
Within 10 days, all of the children and her husband had died. And each time there was the tap, 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 tap at the door. Just slow, rhythmic. And when she got there, no one was there. And my gran said several times during that particular period, she and her a couple of her brothers heard the wailing at night. And the family's name was O'Neill. O'Neill comes from Enail, which is one of the old Irish families.
Well, thank you for depriving me of sleep for the next
So that's the one of the Lay and Shay stories my grandmother told me. But she absolutely meant what she said. She believed that.
It gets scarier every time you tell it to me. I just want an entire episode. I've said this before. I just want an entire episode of you telling the stories that your grandmother passed on
nobody,
to you.
Nobody wants to hear all that.
You are
both
wrong.
Grandmother's So anyway, guys, happy Halloween, or good sewing.
Have a good one, and make sure you tell us if there are any spooky happenings that happen on your side of the world, wherever you happen to be. Have a good one.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.